Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on this Monday, June 2nd, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, and welcome also to the first edition of my previously announced Traitors and Misfits series. It is taking place here on the Heretics Hour, even though I had said I would probably not do it on this show, but on another one, which means it will remain on the Heretics Hour from now on, because I want them to be found in one archive and not spread around. First, I want to thank some valued donors. They are William from Virginia, Richard from Illinois, and Marcus. Way to go, guys. I really appreciate it. It's possible that tonight's show will go overtime. I'm assured that the recording of this program continues for 1 hour after the scheduled end. I'm going to just jump right into this because I'm sure you're interested in why I decided to use the Traitors and Misfits title for tonight's program. The reason is because from my current perspective, the labels fit the two main individuals I will be speaking about. The label traitor I give to my former friend and associate, Tan Staffel, and the label misfit goes to the announced new guiding spirit at MajorityRights.com, Daniel S., whose last name is Polish, and the best I can pronounce it is Sienkiewicz. I could be wrong, and I'm ready to be corrected, and I'm not going to use it anymore, but it's something like Daniel Sienkiewicz, and sometimes in other places he's used his last name. And there's no doubt who this Daniel S. is. Daniel S. is not a stranger to me either. I first met him back in probably 2009, according to my memory, on the J&E discussion group that I'm still on. And he said some things that I took some issue with, or maybe it was the other way around. So maybe maybe he took issue with me. So we had a little back and forth at that time. He was speaking up for Poland's claims about World War II and all that sort of thing. That's pretty much all that it was about. And to my mind, he never gave an inch, even when I thought he should have, and I suppose neither did I. Later, when this show was at Voice of Reason, I noticed when Tom Sunik interviewed Daniel Sienkiewicz, on March 22nd and March 29th, 2011. It was in two parts. Daniel's bio appeared on the program post, and it was surely written by Daniel himself. I refreshed my memory on this by going over to that site today, which I didn't realize that all the programs that are archived there cannot be played. They can't be downloaded. It's just a view-only site. So I was very surprised at that because I guess I had not tried, or maybe in the past I had and they did work, but they don't work now. So that's kind of a shame, but you can read all the posts. And I'm going to read to you just so you get an idea about Daniel, because I have a bit to say about him. And this is very informative of how he describes himself. He says, Daniel Sienkiewicz is a white separatist expat lurking in Eastern Europe. He is of half Polish and half Italian extraction, with a racial awareness born against the Newark, New Jersey race riots of the late 1960s, feminism and forced integration of the 1970s, and the psychological manipulation of the mass media and promotion of miscegenation in the 1980s. It's as difficult to actually read out loud his writing as it is to read it to yourself. It's very convoluted, using a lot of long words that don't seem to be necessary and extra words that don't seem to be necessary. And instead of just saying something in simple terms, he makes it as intellectual, I think he's trying to be, as possible. So we go on here, he says, about himself. He did graduate studies in the USA in the 1990s to cultivate interpretive critical method in advancement of white interests, while not surprisingly unable to complete that program in the hostile environment of the American university. He has continued this effort independently ever since, writing and discussing his explorations on ways to apply hermeneutics, social constructionism, pervasive ecology, other supposedly leftist and, quote, Jewish, unquote, disciplines, but rather for the interests of whites. Not liking where America's rural structure and demographic makeup were headed and wanting to reconnect with his roots, he moved to Eastern Europe. He doesn't want to say, but it's, no, he does say, he says his ideas were born against the Newark, New Jersey race riots. Doesn't say where he was actually born, but it was, I figure it has to be in the United States, where he lived until he was old enough to decide to move around a little bit. The first, now, that's the end of his bio. And speaking about these programs that voice these, the programs that, the interviews with him by Tom Sunik. The first program was a far-ranging discussion on Poland, and the second program was a discussion of white separatism theory and how to get the ship of white separatism on course. Following these appearances with Tom Sunik, Daniel was able to get 6 long essays he wrote published on the Voice of Reason blog. The first one was on October 2011, that same year, and the last one was January 9th, 2012. I could not read them. I mean, I started to read them, and I could never read them. I mostly read the first one, but I don't think I finished it and didn't get anything out of it. And I even asked Mike Connor why he was posting such pretentious stuff that most VOR supporters would not read. And he had, yet at the same time, he had not posted some of my revisionist writings that I had sent to him. He always said he would, but he didn't do these. And I got no answer from him, but I knew he had pretensions himself of moving VOR to a, quote, higher caliber, and he was looking for people he thought might have some, I don't know, some qualifications for being considered some of the better intellectuals of the day. So I'm going to read a little part from the final essay of Daniel that was posted at Voice of Reason to just give you again a little taste of how he writes. The title is Sex as Sacrament, Sex as Celebration, Part 1. And the first 3 paragraphs are, if we can care about the preservation of rainforests, the hills of West Virginia, endangered species in the Gulf of Mexico, and we certainly do care very much, then are we are assuredly warranted by any standard, left, right, or in between, to care for our co-evolutionary people, our co-evolutionary women. A pervasive ecological view, combining as it does the taxonomic system of class, as in the white race, acts as a corrective to Lacanian empiricism, its Cartesian notion of individual rights being prone to rupture systemic evolutionary process. It also acts as a corrective to the toxicity of John Dewey's instrumental pragmatism. That is of significance, as Dewey was particularly resourceful with his instrumentalism, and with that a large influence in promoting liberal democracy, despite his philosophy having serious flaws. Well, I stopped there, but I'm going to read just one more paragraph in that essay about Heidegger, because you might know that I like Martin Heidegger, the philosopher. He was a National Socialist and even a member of Hitler's government for a while. And since Daniel is invariably critical of National Socialism, what he wrote is kind of on the fence here a little bit critical, but it's hard to really understand what he is saying. He writes, while the slow meandering of Heidegger's philosophy makes it better In those regards, the ecological view acts as a corrective to his oversights as well, for example, in regard to, quote, own most being toward death, unquote. This too would be toxic, a good last alternative, but not a proper day-to-day premise for white survival, as nature rarely works within lethal variables. It should be bad enough that miscegenation is possible. Black-on-white murder or the extinction of whites would not even approach appreciable consideration before compelling action on an ecological basis. Well, I'd like to ask you if you know what he meant by all that. What did you get out of that? I would like to have some answers, but you're not able to answer me, so I'll just carry on here. That was the last that I knew of Daniel Sienkiewicz. And more recently, like it might have been sometime around May 15th or earlier, I was moved to check out Majority Rights because I had remembered that it was one of Tan Stoffel's favorite white nationalist comment sites, and he had recommended that I look at it, I think in that last conversation we ever had, maybe earlier. I have for a long time been aware of Majority Rights and sometimes read it, plus they had some good archive material on Holocaust revisionism and Third Reich revisionism, which I had at times linked to and referred to. So I went there and went down the first page. I found this blog article, and it might have been at the top at that time. It is titled For Those Who Will See the Obvious. And that is an article that uses as art that image that I'm using on my program post of the No Hitler, or we don't, what Hitler not welcome here, or whatever, however you want to interpret the portrait of Hitler with red circle with the slanted line crossed through it, which everybody knows means no or don't go here. So I saw that this article, of course it drew my attention, and I saw that it was by Daniel S. And also there are a lot of comments all around the whole website from him. So I thought, boy, he's really writing a lot here. And I remembered him. I knew who he was. And I was wondering if he was able to impress the people at Majority Rights that they should let him become the main voice for that website. I was pretty surprised at that. My idea of Majority Rights was still James Bowery, and I recognized the guest worker as familiar. You know, I never paid a lot of attention to him, but I did remember that he was doing a lot and writing a lot, especially a lot of comments from him, and he was kind of a mainstay. Well, it turns out, I have now learned, that it was guest worker who actually started Majority Rights and ran it since the beginning, and not James Bowery. But James Bowery was very active there, but not so much anymore. And now, though, I discover that guest worker is turning the day-to-day operations over to Daniel S. in September. He will become the guiding spirit of Majority Rights, according to guest worker. And some of the people there are not happy about that. And I can certainly imagine why. Not everybody likes him. Now, before I go on to any more details about Daniel S., who I'm calling the misfit, I'm going to turn to Tan Stoffel, the traitor. I'm under the impression now that Stoffel, I'll call him Stoffel sometimes, just to shorten it up, and Daniel began a communication together before the fateful April 15th end of the White Network. How much more before, I wouldn't know, but several things that I have read and heard at Majority Rights have given me that impression. One of them is that Tan Stoffel was asked to do the May interview with guest worker. That wasn't there this time before when I went there, as I was telling you about, but it's been there since May 29th, just short few days ago. It was posted. Daniel introduced the show, and he introduced Tan, and of course, guest worker is the interviewer for all the radio programs, and it looks like they only have one a month. They have one podcast every month that guest worker does, but Daniel has become part of it. He's there and often causing noise to be made during the program, but he does this introduction. I don't know why it's necessary, but they want to include him, or he wants to be included. I don't know, but anyway, he introduced the show in Tan, and somewhere along the line, guest worker thanked Daniel for setting up the interview with Tan Staple. And I actually have a couple of things in my notes here in comments that were written about the show in which guest worker says that there too. If he didn't say it on the show, he did say it in comments that he thanked Daniel for setting up the interview with Tan Staple. And the reason I'm talking about this tonight in the way that I am is because Staple talked about me in a way that I take exception to on this program, which was only a few days ago. I didn't listen to his program until Saturday evening. And when I did, and somebody had sent me something, some comment about it, well, and then there was a couple other things I decided to do this show, and so I decided I better listen to that program. And when I did, I knew I would go ahead with this show, that I was already planning on Daniel. See, I had something about Daniel, and I didn't know how I was going to use it, and then when I listened to this program Saturday night, I knew I would respond to it in conjunction with talking about Daniel, because I think there's a real connection now between this Daniel S. and Tan Staple. So I would not have been doing another program about Tan Staple, but what he said in his interview that pertains to me is what I'm going to address in this program, and that's why I'm doing it. Now, if he wouldn't have said anything, I wouldn't be saying anything. However, the first thing I want to say, I'm going to go through what he said in this radio interview that has to do with me. That's all. And things are things that maybe I'm not directly in there, but still has to do with what he says about me. And the first thing I want to say as a kind of an introduction remark, and I think it's an absolute truth, a truth that I saw said by a commenter at Daily Stormer a few days ago or some a week, I don't know when it was. And I thought it was an excellent comment, very short, and I think it's absolutely true. And he said, Tan Staple is a walking contradiction. And I think that is the secret of the problems that Tan Staple has when he's talking about a lot of these things, and I think his problems are becoming more serious than they used to be because of all these things he said about me in his effort to justify what he did on April 15th in shutting down, closing down a very vigorous, successful, well-liked radio network for his own personal reasons, and then trying to make it look as though there was something so wrong with me that he felt compelled to do it. And as I've said before, a lot of people fell for that without even investigating the whole thing before they knew anything about it, just because they wanted to take his side over my side. But that's neither here nor there at this point, because I will also tell you right now that at this point, I'm quite happy that just as he is, has said he is, that I'm not associated with him anymore. But I would have been all right if I had never learned all this about him. I had never had this experience that I've had since. I was all right with him. However, the first thing that he said that I thought was pretty telling was, I'm not a gregarious person. I'm not an in-crowd person, in, you know, explaining himself. And he said, in high school, I had a small circle of friends. I believe he was a typical nerd, and he says, I still have these friends today, same friends. He doesn't have much in the way of new friends. He has these same old friends from high school. Not that he doesn't know people and communicate quite a bit, but anyway, I always said after our split up, after the network was ended, that Tan didn't really like people. He didn't really care for people. He didn't want to have to deal with people. That's what I said. He didn't want to have to deal with people much. And I was right, and here he is confirming that himself. he said that he didn't think anything. Well, they were talking about Jews. Oh, he grew up in New York area in the Northeast. He was around New York. There were lots of different ethnic groups, and among them were Jews, and he didn't think anything about Jews except that they thought they were a little bit different, but they were another white group that was just had a funny religion. And he said, you know, the same held true when he got married to his wife. He says, he says, getting married to my wife, whose father was Jewish. You know, and I've noticed that he's starting to avoid calling his wife Jewish or half Jewish, but now he always just says her father was Jewish. He gets around that by somehow, it sounds less like he's calling his wife a Jew, but the fact is her father was a full Jew. And he has described on several occasions her father as apparently a fine man in every respect, not religious, but he was known to be kind and helpful to everyone. Things like that, I know that's generally the gist of what he would say about it. And so here's the first contradiction, a big, big contradiction, that Tan Staffels is mostly identified with the fact that all Jews are biological parasites and there are no good Jews. He worked his way up to that, and he was there already at the time that he and I became friends and started Skyping together and talking together. And he came on my show, and we really had a nice relationship. We really liked each other. And he already had that idea then. Of course, when I first came in contact with him, I won't repeat that story, but I did then look at some of his blog posts, and then I saw his personal disclosure, and I read it, and I thought, he didn't have to say this since he's anonymous, and he could have tried to keep it covered up, but he didn't. So I guess he's a person who really wants to be honest. He doesn't want anything that's, that he has to hide. And that speaks well of him, because I like honest people who don't make things, who don't lie. So, but people have brought this up, that since his position on Jews is so unbending, and yet he's been living with this daughter of a full Jew, parasites, biological parasites, and it's in his children. But he used to act kind of... I don't know what word to use. I was going to say a little bit ashamed, but it's not. I don't want to say that. Just a little bit like he was, as he says later on, he's damaged goods, something like that. He used to behave that way a little more, but he seems to have shed that quite a bit because of the attention he got via the white network, and so he is. He seems like he doesn't feel that way about his family, but he still holds that belief that. For everybody else, for every other Jew. So that's a big contradiction. He then goes to because of the kind of questions that he was getting from guest workers, he says, my grandmother was German, and I speak a little bit of German because of just being around it, my mother was fluent. Well, I was amazed. I've never heard that before. And he botches every German word I've ever heard him say. He botches non-German words, too. He does a lot of mispronunciation by not looking words up. But I can't imagine. He said he has relatives still living in Germany, and he's visited with them. Maybe they came here. I don't know. He's never said he's gone to Germany. But, you know, I never heard any of this ever before in all our conversations. And I would certainly like to hear him speak some German. If he can speak a little bit of German, why doesn't he do so? And then guest worker remarks that German-American influence in white nationalism today is so strong, implying kind of in a vague way that this is a problem with the favoritism about the Third Reich and Hitler, because there's so many Germans in white nationalism. So Tan says, Germans were immigrating like the Hispanics today. I didn't think that sounded too good, but he says they had already displaced the Anglo-Saxons in the United States that they had created. I think that sentence is kind of messed up there. had already been ethnically cleansed by the Irish and the Germans. He means the Anglo-Saxons in the United States had already, who created the United States, had already been ethnically cleansed by the Irish and the Germans. Ethnically cleansed, strange word to use. So it's natural, but then, you know, they're into this terminology that they use over there at, not all of them, but some of them over there at Majority Rights, and certainly Guest Worker uses it. Tan likes to use this type of terminology to call it use ethnically cleansed instead of just saying that there were larger numbers of them, something like that. And some of the people there like to talk like that. They have their own kind of language. So he says, so it's natural that there's a strong German influence amongst the white nationalists in the United States. And I've had my own conflict just recently. The end of the white network had something to do with this conflict between, and then as he's speaking, Guest Worker says, yes. Tan says, between somebody who is obsessed with setting the record straight about a very select group of people and a very select period of time. So, of course, he's referring to me. That this is a conflict because there's too much concern for Germans, basically. Of course, I comment right here that Jews, which Tan Staffel is obsessed about, as everybody knows, are an even smaller group of people than the Germans by far. And yet, you know, so kind of funny. But so Tan goes on. Tan is still talking. He says, funny thing about protecting the German people and the memory of the German people and standing up for the German people, is it's the German people in Germany that they're most concerned with, it seems, rather than the German Americans who, amazingly to me, and this is just evidence that it's not really white people that have some recent flaw, that we've all become cowards and idiots and do whatever the Jews say, but during World War I and World War II, despite the fact that German was the number one ethnicity in the United States, millions of, or at least hundreds of thousands of German boys marched off to war against their fatherland in both wars. There was resistance against it, but in the end, they went to war. That amazes me. Every time people criticize white people for being stupid, for suiciding ourselves, it's easy to think of these counterexamples, that this has been going on for a long time. It doesn't just apply to one group today or, well, let's leave it there. Well, he decides not to say any more. I don't know exactly what he was meaning to say, but I want to make a few comments here. One is that when he says the Germans are the largest ethnic group in the United States, he's disregarding, and so does Guest Worker. They disregard the fact that the English, the largest demographic of whites in the United States, is the combined English, Scots-Irish, Welsh, otherwise known as the people living in the United Kingdom. That doesn't even include others, and that doesn't include the Irish, just the Scots-Irish. But that's much larger. I don't have a number for it because they don't even give one. That's the founding race of the United States, and there's more of them than anything else among white people. 17%, and this was in a recent census, 17% identify themselves as German-American, 12% identify themselves as Irish, and those are by far the two largest, and they don't even give the one for English. There's a Scottish. Well, I don't know if there's a number for it, though. But I would combine English, Scots-Irish, and even Welsh, because, you know, Welsh is a small group in themselves. And I'd even include Irish, but the Irish don't want to be included with the English, so they consider themselves a separate whatever. The Irish are Celts, and the English, Scottish, have German ancestry, along with Norman and British and what have you. I'm not an expert on that. But so this, I think they're trying to exaggerate the number of ethnic Germans in the United States. And it's funny here also, he says, hundreds of thousands of German boys marched off to war against their fatherland. Well, they were German-American boys. You know, let's remember that. And they were American citizens. And they had to. They were drafted. And maybe they weren't drafted. I don't know about the First World War, but in the First World War, Germans were not so anxious to go to Europe and fight. They were not. So I don't know. I think he doesn't know what he's talking about, as so often is the case when he makes out this thing that all these German American boys are just so ready and anxious to go and fight Germany. They weren't. And I'm closer to that time than he is, and he really doesn't know much. He doesn't know much, but he's always trying to justify himself by saying things that he hasn't studied. He's not different from other people in that. A little later, he said, Europeans think in terms of nation, not white. Well, who's been saying that? I've been saying that for a long time, and other people have said that. He wasn't, but he finally is saying it now. He says, for them, white means Polish plumbers moving to England, France, or Germany, screwing their daughters and giving them mongrel children. And they're right. This I found really interesting when he says, and they're right. Tan is trying to present himself as a friend to all European and all whites. He identifies most with white, but all European whites. I have just this narrow focus on Germany, and I don't like Slavs and so on. But he's saying that in Europe, there's a lot of that feeling, and that they don't want white Polish plumbers or white Poles moving into their country and screwing their daughters and giving them mongrel children. He called it that. He called it mongrel children. And yet we're talking about all white people, supposedly. And then he says, and they're right. Now, this is exactly what I was talking about on the program he used to justify his shutting down the white network. On his disgusting show post, My Mistake, he wrote, during her two-hour program this past Saturday, she demonstrated her ignorance, confusion, and hostility toward not just white nationalism, but the very purpose of this website. But see, he's now saying part of what I was saying then, because that's what I was talking about, the difference between national nationalists in Europe and white nationalists, because showing that white nationalism began in America, in the United States, because we couldn't really do a national nationalism here, because there's so many people of varied ethnicities. So now he's taking on what I was saying, but it's okay now, but I'm still guilty. According to him, I wouldn't mind having a debate or a discussion with him, with a person who you could trust to moderate fairly. But at the same time, it wouldn't go anywhere. It'd probably just, you know, be arguing the awful. The other thing that he used, I have to go into this now because this is part of why I'm doing this again. Another thing he used in his show called My Mistake, I think it's from My Mistake, he said that he used three quotes from me that he thought made me guilty of being disloyal to him and to the network and all that kind of stuff. Of course, among them was, beyond these three, is the table talk programs I was doing and the comments that were going on in those program pages. And, you know, he's monitoring, and he always has been doing it, and he's broken in at previous times, monitoring the comments on my show pages, because he doesn't get very many comments. I got most of the comments. Sometimes he got, you know, a number of them, but most of the time not. And seeing if there's anything he disapproves of. Obviously, he was doing that. So apart from the table talk programs, he says, which I want to comment here. I'll do that right now. The table talk programs. Now, here's where the problem with table talk comes from, in my opinion, because on May 1st, Daniel S. is very much against table talk, and he wrote comment, they just have comments galore there at Majority Rights, to Jimmy, can't think of his last name, but he wrote this, Carolyn does provide an illustration. This was, I think, from the previous radio program before the one with Tan, which was with Tom Metzger. He says, Carolyn does provide an illustration of just how loyal a white woman can be, even to the most stigmatized of positions, in defending a white people. However, she is loyal in unanimity to a narrow fault. You know, see that language again. Loyal in unanimity to a narrow fault. You have to spend a little bit of time figuring out what you think he means by that. She is not a white nationalist. She is a German chauvinist. Well, this turns out to be exactly almost what Tanstaffel said in his final show talking about me, saying that I'm not a white nationalist, but a German nationalist. But I think that Daniel is already talking to him like this before this. This is not the first time Daniel said these things. And he goes on, her value to the struggle is indirect, you know. And then he says, Tanstaffel should have he's talking to Jimmy, see. Tanstaffel should have realized this from the start, that I was a German chauvinist, according to him. And he should not have joined forces with her. But he remained inarticulate or in denial of the fact until he was forced to recognize it upon her approval of Hitler's sentiments in table talk. Even then, the many furtive issues that he brought into his reasoning for departure showed that he remained inarticulate of the fact in parsimony that she is a German chauvinist, not a white nationalist. It's clear, simple, that that's all you really need to know if white nationalism is your concern. Well, what I say about this is that obviously Daniel was counseling Tanstaffel, and because there's other things also that I've come across. And so this is my position, that Daniel was counseling Tanstaffel and is a bit disappointed in how Tanstaffel performed his task. And he's saying so in this post here from May 1st. But I'll go back now to these three comments that Tan noted as I asked him for some proof about what it was that I said. Well, he put this in his program anyway. I wrote in a comment, to me, increasingly, I see white nationalism as a tool of the globalist, internationalist Jews to give us an impossible ideal which they can infiltrate and control. And you are a part of that. I was talking, you know who I was talking to Franklin Reichardt, who is writing in, and I was responding to him because he was attacking Hitler and National Socialism very strongly and saying a lot of things that weren't true. And so in the course of that, he's talking about that what is a white nationalist and so on. And then in another place, and this is all out of context, you know, you don't have to look for, I couldn't even find this, but I suppose it is there somewhere. I said, what the hell are you doing calling yourself a white nationalist? I would have said this to Franklin Reichardt. I will no longer call myself that. Oh, how horrible. I said, I wrote there, I will no longer call myself that. And then the third one is, I said, again, I'm sure it was to Franklin Reichardt. Yikes, one way of leveling the playing field is to exterminate Germans outright, isn't it? I am toying with the possibility that white nationalism is being used to the advantage of the Jew. And that was just horrible. And for that, Tanstaffel thinks that I have abused his system and he has to get rid of me and try to shut me up. But the thing is here that I noticed when I was reading this that Daniel says Tan, in giving the reasons for his departure, showed blah, blah, blah. Well, if Tan just departed from the white network, that would have been a different story. And if he even departed and took his software with him, that would have been a different story. Because he could have, I guess, disengaged his software from the server and left the website, left some kind of website, left the website in some, and left me there to figure out what to do with the white network. Because it wasn't his. He keeps talking, you'll find out later on how he talks about the software all the time. But see, he didn't do that. What he did was he closed me out. He then changed all the passwords, and he announced that there would be no more white network. There would be no more shows, not for anybody. He didn't just leave himself. He took it down, and when he decided to do this, which because he decided the day before, and even before that, he didn't know that Paul Hickman was no longer there. And he was still going to do it, although he said that when he learned that Paul Hickman had left, that it made it easier for him, but it didn't cause him to make that decision then. So he didn't care who he was stopping. He just was doing what he wanted to do based on his idea that he had every right to do it. So let's see, this Daniel says some more stuff about me, but I think I'll pass that by for now. And I say that Daniel is, it's easy to see that this came from his new friendship with Daniel. That what Tan was saying, all the things that Tan was upset about, had been pointed out to him, I believe, by Daniel S. And Daniel S. had already written very negatively about Table Talk, along with Mein Kampf, and probably complained a lot to Tan in their new friendship conversations about what it says and what I said. And otherwise, Tan Staffel might have passed it over, might not have noticed it. So Tan, you know, we talked about, I want to refer back to Tan Staffel saying about for white Europeans, white nationalist Europeans, Poles moving in, just the example he gave, Poles moving into their countries and screwing their daughters and giving them mongrel children and their right, Tan Staffel is a real mongrel. He's made up, as he has said on this program, and he said before, he's made up of five different European nationalities. Five of them. He's one of them is German. The other is other grandparent is Irish Swedish, so it's just half and half of that. Another grandparent is Sicilian. Another grandparent is Scots Irish English, something along those lines. Probably more Scots, but they're not sure. So. You know, to be mixed up so much like that, just because it's all white people, if Sicilians fit that mode, a lot of them don't, he doesn't understand the feelings of someone who is 100% anything. His whole family is hopelessly mongrelized. So he's left with being white. He's left with white nationalism. He's left with Americanism. And his whole interest is in America. He doesn't really relate to Europeans, and he even says so in this program. So he thinks that he wanted something that was all about that, and therefore I was supposed to provide that with him, and I couldn't do anything different on different days and on different occasions, different programs, obviously, which I was not aware. And I had already worked out some of these ideas, and I'm continuing with these ideas. So I'm glad I'm not in a situation where I feel like I can't continue with them. Like I'm trying to protect something, protect the white net, my position, you know, continuing having the white network in order to, I have to be careful about what I say. So I wouldn't like that, and I wouldn't want that. So it's all just as well. But I will say that the way this, while I'm on this topic, the way this should have been done, a way it could have been done, would be that he would have been open and honest with me, and we would have talked it out ourselves, and we would have accepted the inevitable that was being presented by each one of us, and we would have worked out some arrangement, and we would have made a joint statement in a civil way. And then we would have, you know, dismantled things accordingly. But no, Tan didn't want to do that. And in my very considered opinion, the reason he didn't want to do that was because he's passive-aggressive, and he couldn't confront me except in a kind of an angry way. He couldn't confront, because people like this don't feel convinced of their argument, and they're not sure that they will be able to stand firm when they talk to the other person. They feel like they're at a disadvantage because they're passive people. But then they get aggressive by building up a real case against this person, and they exaggerate in their mind what's been done to them. And they then come at you real, real angry and in a kind of an explosive way, and they say, you know, you've done this and you've done that. You get out of here and I never want to see you again and go away. I'm locking you out, things like that. That's, in my opinion, why it was done that way, because it didn't need to be done that way. And it's not something that I ever would have expected from this person, from this man. That's my opinion. So then going on with the interview, guest worker says, obviously, and I didn't like this, he says, obviously, Titan, in a gentle way, he says, you've been through this slightly negative experience with Carolyn Yeager, and you've now reemerged as a writer. Well, I don't think that the experience was negative until he closed down the network. Then it became very negative. But it may be here that guest worker is trying to tone Tan down by calling it just slightly negative, so it's not a really big deal. And anyway, it's kind of stupid that he says you've now reemerged as a writer, because he never stopped writing and he wasn't writing any differently than he had been writing before. It may be that guest worker was not all that familiar with Tan's background. But he says, are you going to sort of develop back again into being in with some nationalist medium or be a lone blogger? Or, and Tan says, I've always been a loner my whole life, as I've described in the small circle of friends I have, as I've described the small circle of friends I have. So there you have that again. He said, I don't really care to have so many people around me. I don't need to be part of an organization. You know, and I would say to Tan, it's not about need. It's not whether you need to be a part of it. It's about support and comradeship, which he seems to think he's giving, or people should give. He's the perfect white nationalist, but he thinks that he doesn't want to be a part of an organization. He doesn't want to have people around him. He likes being a loner. He likes being just doing his own thing. And he says, I was leery about partnering. Now he comes back to me again. I was leery about partnering with anyone, but I did want to do something, and I wanted to, at that point in time, 2 years ago, when we were starting the White Network, I had recently been meeting with people and getting more into the physical world of finding out who's behind these handles online, and I wanted to become more active. When Carolyn proposed to me that we start this radio network, now there you are, as I've always said, it was my idea. And the White Network was my idea. He never did deny that. And I went to him asking him if he would like to be a part of it. It wasn't his idea. He doesn't have big ideas, because he's this loner guy who doesn't want to, you know, really be a part of anything much. So he doesn't get big ideas of doing things. But he says that he, and it's true, I remember all this, you know, he'd been meeting people, and apparently he was wanting to get more involved at this very time. And he said, I thought this was a way to do it. Starting this network was, from my point of view, so my show could continue after VOR, GW says, collapsed. And Tan goes on, well, I've already talked about this. But yeah, it was collapsing. She wasn't happy there because she felt constrained about what she could talk about. I feel constrained. Yeah, I didn't feel so constrained about what I could talk about. I just didn't like the surroundings, and I didn't like the lack of the more and more non-white people and Jews and homosexuals that were taking over there. But now Tan constrained me about what I could talk about, didn't he? It's funny, because he was very sympathetic about that one story about Dr. Day. And then he says that I was being censored there at VOR, but now he then turned around and started censoring me here at the White Network. Just, there's another contradiction. I forgot to mark all the contradictions. There's probably a few there I've already covered. And here's a big contradiction. And he says she wasn't happy there because she felt constrained about what she could talk about. And I had liked her. It's true. I know he did. And I liked him. We liked each other very much. The topics that I had liked her, the topics that she talked about exposed me to a criticism of the Holocaust, that and an exposure of history, that a point of view that I was not all that familiar with. And I thought, well, this is great stuff. Yeah, he was ignorant. He was ignorant about all that stuff, and he was really eating it up. He listened to every one of my programs and went back into the ones I had done before he found out about me, and he and his whole family would listen to him, he told me. Yeah, he said, now I can help, he said, when I approached him with this. Now I can help. I can start a radio network. I can give not only her a platform, but hopefully some other people too, and myself. I can do this too. Well, in the beginning, we talked, and I brought it up, and we'd want to have more than just, I encouraged him to do a show. He said for quite a while, well, I'm not sure I'm going to do a show. You know, I just want to do this so you can do your show. And he only had the Heretics Hour in mind. But I thought, well, you know, if we have to do this, then well, we can have some other people on. And he said, yeah, okay, yeah. So then he goes on to say here on the program, I can indulge my own interests and talk about what I want to talk about. And that's what I did for 2 years. But in the end, a partnership is unstable because when you try to pretend that two people are in charge, well, the minute they disagree about something serious, it collapses. Well, in my opinion, there was nothing so serious as to make our partnership collapse. Truly, I didn't think so. But obviously, I didn't understand what Tan was thinking. And I don't think that he thought that up until the last couple of weeks, you know, before he did it. He didn't. I know. It was more like the last 10 days. And I just think that but he may have been communicating with this Daniel for a while and taking in these ideas about how bad German nationalism is and how, you know, because the things he said before about that I already read to you were kind of revealing. So he goes on, I know she would have liked me to have just left her my software to do with what she pleases, but every time she speaks ever since, I thank my stars that I didn't leave her my software so that she could be saying the nasty things she's saying using my own software. Guest worker interferes here, and he starts giving advice to Tan Staffel to stop talking about it. You know, basically, he says a few things, but he's saying it's better. The more you talk about this, the more you're going to be identified with it. So it's best to just stop right now. And Tan laughs at this, gives a kind of a nervous laugh, and then he says, "Yes, and that's what I've tried to do, but I'm not trying to erase the past. I'm not going around trying to delete what's been said, and she's free to say what she wants." Well, now he's accusing me, as he really wants to do, and he has been doing all along, both at his archive, where he keeps adding, you know, he's got new things he puts on there, and at Metapedia now, accusing me of trying to delete things because I don't want people to know what I said. And that is not true. It's absolutely, categorically not the reason anything has been deleted at all. But this is his story, and he sticks with it. Then he says, again, this thing about his own software, you know, and I already mentioned that he didn't have this proprietary attitude about his software earlier. In fact, at one point, he said he was thinking about making his software, it didn't work all that well, but available to any white nationalists that wanted to use it so people could start their own radio programs and so on. And I told him about, I didn't like that too much because there were a lot of people who were doing things I didn't particularly think were any good. And I mentioned some things to him, and he says, well, I better not then. So he was very free about the software, but more and more he got thinking more of himself as time went on, because once he started the radio program, which I had to kind of talk him into. But now he says he always wanted to do it, but he didn't tell me that. He said differently. But he said, I was happy at the White Network, happy doing the podcast. See, now there he is. He said people think he had such a terrible time, and he worked so hard. Now, he didn't work hard. He didn't have that much to do. Once he created that software, it ran on its own, and he just had to be there when something went wrong and start to boot the system again. That's all. And everybody did all their own stuff. So, and he was happy. He was saying he was happy doing the podcast. I was the podcast I was doing, he said. I was learning a lot myself about things I had always wanted to understand better, and I was sharing what I was learning with people. That's what I'm going to continue to be doing. I don't want to be part of a larger political organization. With the Jewish issue with me, you know, with my wife's father, it's a sore point. I am basically damaged goods. I'm compromised. I'm in no position to get up and lead white people against the Jews. Well, he's happy about that. He's happy because he doesn't want to. He wants to just stay in his own little company and do what he wants. And he likes Tom Metzger a lot. And so I guess he likes the lone wolf idea. And he'd rather just, he thinks he can just do what he does. And that's the contribution that he can make. He doesn't need to make more of one. He says that even though he's in no position to get up and lead white people against the Jews, but I can't help myself but to observe and share my observations of what I see as the problem, you know, proposed solutions. But I don't, and I can't put myself forward as a leader. And that's part of why I did what I've done for the last few years in sort of running the network and staying mainly in the background other than doing my podcast. I'm not interested in becoming a Paul Weston and starting a party, etc. I don't want, and he goes on about more stuff. Well, they were talking about Paul Weston earlier, and, you know, the whole thing really is that Tan doesn't want any work. He doesn't want responsibility more than what he had with designing this white network and doing his 30 minutes a week. That's it. And he's not a hard worker. So, but he does love to talk. He loves to talk. Well, you know, a lot of us can say that. He's not any different, but he's got this personal problem. So, you know, he's a man in his 40s, but he's home free from having to step up to the plate for white nationalism because he married a Jew. That's what it comes down to, and he's happy about that. He's very happy about it. He doesn't want to step up to the plate for white nationalism. He likes what he's doing because he's likes to analyze and talk about things. He likes his radio now. And then he said, and I'm very leery about partnering with anyone after this too, because I don't want it to become a big soap opera like this one has become. Well, that really gets my goat, because as I said I've already said on another program, but his last program, he gets on the air without preparing anyone for any of it. And he announces the end of the white network. And in the way he did it, was that not a soap opera? I can't think of anything that's more soap opera than his last program, which he called My Mistake, and blamed me for the reason that he was finished with the white network. And as soon as his show finished, he posted a blog that said there's not going to be any more, you know, it's the end of the white network. So he didn't just leave the white network. He took the white network down. He didn't so much take it down. I guess I ended up taking it down, but shut it down. He shut it down. And the way he did it was the biggest soap opera I've ever seen. And he enjoyed every bit of it. He enjoyed doing that. So that's where the soap opera started, and if it's been a soap opera since, it's his own fault. I said already the way it could have been done. I would not have argued. How can you argue with somebody who wants to leave and wants to do what they're doing? You can't keep them there. But he didn't want me to have any, in my opinion, and I'm sure that I'm right, is that he got so attached to the white network. He thought so highly of it. You know, it had become pretty successful. He was so proud, not just of his software, but he was so proud of being associated with it that he wanted to keep it just the way it was when he was there. And he didn't want it to continue on without him and becoming something that maybe he wouldn't, you know, that he wasn't a part of and he wouldn't be so proud of. He had to end it. He had to end it for that reason, because he felt he had such an investment in it, and it was so much a part of him. And I think for Tan Stoffel, this was the most important thing and the best thing he'd ever done for white nationalism in his whole life. Of course, he wasn't always a white nationalist, but he felt it was some kind of testament, and like men tend to feel about their accomplishments, a testament to him, and he had to protect it and keep it for himself, for himself. That's why he tries to minimize what I've done, and that, you know, it all belonged to him and things like that. So, but anyway, guest worker says, this is about the segment of our people who will fight. He then talks about me, Carolyn, guest worker. And I imagine this took Tan by surprise, but he said, she is a very strong person. She's a very fine person in many ways. I mean, many, many years ago, it's not that many, many years ago, I remember sending her a mail saying, thanks very much for the work you're doing. Because I went through a phase, I was learning a lot from people, and I learned from Carolyn, as I did from others. And I did let them know it. But I do think that do I think that I could settle down and actually work with somebody that original? No, I don't think so. So he's calling me very original and very strong. And oh, I accept that. I don't have any problem with that. I think it's true. Tan Staffel then makes some comments on the way we treat. They were talking about how to handle comments, you know, how whether to let everybody have their say or whether to moderate more strictly and what kind of people should not be allowed to comment and so on. So Tan Staffel said, Carolyn Yeager has a much stricter attitude about not posting any opposing opinion unless she can immediately make them look foolish right afterward. And she always feels compelled to answer any criticism right away. You see how he has to portray me in a negative light over and over again. He can't stop. And that, in my opinion, is because he keeps having to justify what he's done. Because eventually people are going to see it the way it should be seen, and he's not going to have all these people backing him up any longer, unless he does something, but it doesn't look like he's going to do anything. And I say that, yeah, I do feel compelled to answer. I always feel compelled to respond right away. I am bad about that because I answer people too quickly. And I also often, if I would wait a little while, as Hitler was saying in the table talk last Thursday that we read, if you people are going to sue someone for insulting them, if they should have a law that you have to wait 3 weeks or something before you can file your suit, and he said in that period of time people would relax about it and change their mind and wouldn't do it, and that's what I've learned, that if I don't. I will often not care or would answer differently, but there is something in me that compels me that I need to answer that. I need to respond to that. But it's not because it's critical, because I feel that way about everything, good comments and critical comments. I see the value of doing that, although more for critical comments, because I don't like to see that standing there without being answered. So Tan says, I see the value of doing that, though, especially in creating the White Network. The whole idea was to create a space for ourselves that would, where we could talk without this constant noise being added, trying to derail us. And I think that idea is not a wrong idea. Well, there he's finally being a little honest there, because that was the idea of the White Network, that it was going to be only white people talking, and we were not going to allow non-white people to join the conversation. Because we agreed that they had different motives and agendas, and they were often more or less an infiltrating force. So, and I got that idea from being at Voice of Reason, because there was so much of that there, and Tan agreed with that at the time. Then he started doing the same thing at Age of Treason. He stopped lying, stopped accepting all comments and started moderating them. And he told me that he decided I was right about that. That was a good idea. So here he starts out that he wants to criticize me about the way I handle comments, but then he agrees that he thought it was a good idea. Now then, guest worker says, I'm done with this. Guess what, folks? I'm done with this Tan Staffel part. Guest worker, though, says one thing in the course of this interview with Tan Staffel, and it is, I thought it was quite important. He says, it is a mark of our civilization how we treat the Jews. I do believe they were exterminated. I believe there was a genocide. They were certainly enslaved. And he uses some descriptive terms about it, which I didn't take all down, but the last one was, he said, an act of viciousness, meaning that the National Socialists and the people involved in the concentration camps and so on were carrying out acts of viciousness. And the people that made the decisions were, it was all about viciousness. And he says, it is absolutely necessary to treat Jews in a way that leaves us free of any trespass of theirs on our life. Tanstaffel doesn't respond at all to any of this. He says nothing. But guest worker goes on to say, the answer is segregation. And then he says, I don't mind that Jews come into our world. They are successful. For example, Gottfried, and he starts talking about Gottfried, which Tanstaffel then doesn't agree with and does say something. But it's interesting when he says it's absolutely necessary to treat Jews in a way that leaves us free of any trespass of theirs on our life. What he means is that if we mistreat Jews, then they can accuse us of that. So we should never mistreat Jews. So they don't have any reason to accuse us of doing anything wrong to them. But, you know, that doesn't fit reality, because Jews will accuse you of the worst crimes against them that they can get away with, whether you do it or not. You can say, we didn't do any of this, but very often people are going to believe that you did. I think guest worker is several things. He seems to be a kind of a decent guy, and he's certainly well-meaning, I think, but two things. He's too humanitarian, and even with the Jews. And then he's got that British prejudice against Germans it's just there in so many British. They can't undo it because I guess it was put there so early in their life, and it's so generally believed among the British that the Germans must have done a lot of things very bad, or we wouldn't have done to them what we did. They must have done these bad things. It's just this anti-Germanism that exists in English people. And I think he's got that, plus that he hasn't studied the Holocaust. So he, like Mark Weber, he probably agrees with Mark, thinks Mark Weber knows what he's talking about. And so he has these beliefs. And if I were talking to him there, I would start to explain to him why he's wrong. But Tan doesn't do that, because Tan is not a Holocaust revisionist, and he doesn't go into that. He thinks about it very much the same way, I think, now that Greg Johnson does. That's what I think. I think they're all coming from that same place. They don't want to make the Germans so important, basically. Okay, I just want to make the comment here that when guest worker says this about Jews, that we have to treat Jews in a way that leaves us free from any claims that we have harmed them, that they can make against us, Tan doesn't have any problem. And he's back there, he's, you know, commenting, he's going to go, you know, he wants to participate there. But when I question the effectiveness of white nationalism, which is basically no different than what GW is doing, although GW is doing something worse, I just questioned the effectiveness of white nationalism. Tanstaffel blew a gasket and acted like I was abusing him and the network and the system, his system, and I had no right to question this. I had no right to question it. And I think he's not going to be able to continue to hold that. Probably eventually he won't even accept it for himself. So, as I said, majority rights is going to be in September turned over to this Daniel S. And I'd say my thinking is that, wow, things are really going to go downhill fast there. I can't imagine a person like him. It's such a Polish national. He's a Polish chauvinist. Hattie Scott called him that in a long thread of comments at the Occidental Observer at the end of 2011, and it carried on into the very beginning of 2012, the first days of January, this thread that was going on based on, what was it based? Oh, based on an article by Tom Sunick. And Daniel S. was very much present there. There are a lot of comments. I looked them over this morning. And Hadding made a lot, too. And they got going at each other quite a bit, along with a couple of other people that Hadding got disagreed with, and they disagreed with him. And Hadding did really well there, Hadding Scott. And considering the things that this Daniel S. believes, I just can't imagine how he can run things there, how he can be the leader there. He's going to make some changes, it said. Not that I care. I mean, it's not a site I go to. But I'm just talking about this because of what this Daniel S. believes. So his latest blog post, and he's written quite a lot there, is the one I mentioned in the beginning. For those who will see the obvious, which was posted by him on April 20th. So I'm not saying it's connected with what happened at the White Network. It's 5 days after the White Network was shut down, but I don't think it's connected with that, but it's just around that time. I'm just kind of putting it into a place. It's a month and a half ago, perhaps, almost, not quite. So it's very recent, and I guess I won't read it all, but I'm going to read some things that I highlighted out of it. He says that his proposition is that Hitler and the Nazis were not white European nationalists, nor can they represent the interests of white European peoples. Now, he being half Polish and half Italian, according to him, but definitely identifying with the Polish side of his family and having a Polish name, he's very identified as a Pole. It doesn't seem to ever talk about the Italians. And like most Poles, has a lot of resentment toward Germany, and he in particular has been very active in trying to talk people out of having any kind of a good opinion of Adolf Hitler or anything that he did or anything about Adolf Hitler's regime the whole time he was there, you know, the whole time he was chancellor. I mean, there's nothing good about this man, according to him. So he writes, I would like to clear the way further for majority rights as a place of sanity for white interests. And a place of sanity means that, he says, if a former head of state where I am from had the attitude toward Germans in Germany that Hitler had, for example, toward Slavs in Eastern Europe, frankly, I would not boast of this man, but would be eager to leave him in the past as an embarrassing expression of overcompensation. Hitler's was a position which could only have led to the inter-European fighting and diversion from our proper organization. He presents himself, Daniel, as a European, pro-European, pro-pan-European, pro-European unity, pro-European all over the world, including Americans and Canadians and what have you, and all equal, all unifying on a kind of an equal level, which doesn't seem to ever gotten anywhere. There's never been such a thing, and I don't think there can be either, but this is the ideal that so many people have of white nationalism, and they see this as giving us a lot of power. Gee, if we would all just unify, look at how strong we would be. Except there's things that prevent our unifying like that, and they're always going to prevent it. He says how he likes Germans, and he doesn't hold any bad feelings for Germans, and he tries to help unburden Germans of their guilt, which is undeserved, and that today's generations have had nothing to do with World War II, and World War II is so long ago that we should just forget it and move on and join together in Europeanness. Well, naturally, that would be the hope, the idea of a Polish partisan, because if everybody is European, then the Poles cannot be excluded whatsoever, because he sees the European, of course, as West European, East European, all one Europe. And at the same time, they don't have to deal with World War II truth, which is not the way the Poles are presented in this narrative, and they don't want that to change. So he's very partisan Polish, but he says, just some of the things he says are, let there be no mistake, those who insist upon Hitler and Nazism are not white nationalists. Well, that sounds like what Tanstoffel was saying to me. If you care more about Hitler and National Socialism, you're not a white nationalist. You can't do that. He says, then this Daniel makes a statement, it does not represent whites, but only a narrow and creepy few, speaking about the actual National Socialists in Germany of that time. They did not represent whites, but only a narrow and creepy few. And those who are still holding on to that today, it's the same thing. He says, now he talks about white leftism. And he says, really, what you are seeing in the difficulties that white nationalism is having and that whites are having and all of the disloyal white people, what you're seeing is what happens, in effect, when we confuse white leftist control for Jewish prescribed liberalism for whites. He means he said we shouldn't confuse white leftist control for Jewish liberalism, because he is recommending, along with Tom Metzger, the white left, a white left. He said it would be difficult for Nazi right-wingers to accept that their heroes were the massive screw-ups, and he's being kind with those words, that they were. It is hard for them to acknowledge that they gained popularity under color of the left, and then they gained power through a sense of moral high ground, which they would then betray. He really has nothing ever positive at all to say about the National Socialists, and he always calls them Nazis. And in fact, so does Guest Worker, and so do a lot of people there at, I'm sure they don't all, but at Majority Rights. His writing is so hard, it's so unpleasant, convoluted. He says, how else to explain the gifts that white people have bestowed with their technologies and legal skills of being able to watch women who should be our wives being sodomized by Negroes? Well, I can't explain what he's getting at there, but without reading a bunch of the rest of it. But he says fairly often, I've seen it before, that he talks about the white women should be our wives, but they're going out with Negroes. You know, he sees feminism as a big, big problem, and he sees that white women are like their property. You know, they're ours. White women are ours. They belong to us white men, but they're going off with non-white men. And it just makes me wonder, I bet this Daniel S. is the most unattractive person. I bet he is. And he doesn't have a woman or a wife. He's probably single. And who knows if he even wants one. But he talks like this because this is the way that the talk is done. And he says, but we, the white left, know that they have put their nose to the grindstone, unappreciated, betrayed, in fact. Who has? I guess the working class. But he says, the malice that Hitler held for other European peoples, that rejecting Hitler's worldview does not entail including Jews in our category of European people, does not mean rejecting Germans. He thinks if he doesn't reject Germans, that he's doing good. He says, we can think for ourselves. Then he says, what makes this all so stupid, of course, is that white nationalists are not and never have been against Germans or German nationalism, but Nazis are against other white European folk. This is one of his big themes. White nationalists are friendly to Germans. They're not against Germans, and they welcome Germans. And you can, you know, even German nationalism, because, you know, every people can feel nationalistic toward their own nation and their own people. But Nazis are different. Nazis are against other white European folk. This is, he's, he's convinced of that, and he doesn't change it. He won't change his mind. And then he shows a picture of one of the most unflattering pictures of Himmler I ever saw. And he says, if I looked like Himmler, I wouldn't talk so much about race. Just, you know, again, putting down the hated Nazis. And here's something that's important. He says, this is to provide one answer, anyway, to guest workers' question of what we are missing, a non-Hitler-esque position that welcomes participation of white people without raising the specter that right-wing elitism is going to exploit and extinguish them. He wants white nationalism and majority rights to be able to provide a position that doesn't include Hitler, that welcomes white people without the right-wing elitism that makes people fearful of white nationalism, because there's too much right-wing elitism in it. And then he says, you see, the white left, while it is so speculative as to believe in the parameters of biological race, is following Kant's advice of keeping a principle. In fact, our race and its compartments as a principle, since it is easier to correct sensible oversights than to reconstruct that principle as we have found. Once again, what we're dealing with is a growing number of people who are coming from the left or going or wanting or switching over to the left from the right, rejecting the right, going to the left and calling it the white left. The white left, then they try to back it up philosophically with various things. He talks about Kant. He talks about Wittgenstein, you know, as though he knows anything. Then he says the left, a white left, is taking measure of the full scope of European people. It begs the question of redefinition. What do you mean, the white left? Well, you know, he's going on about people don't understand it. We have to explain it to them. But it's the right way to go in his estimation. And he says the answer is, of course, the white class. He talks about the white left and the white class. I'm not clear what the white class is. I didn't really look for it, but the white class is none of those negative things that the right and the Jewish liberal left would like to have attributed to leftism. He blames the right on taking people astray and joining forces with Jews and Jewish ideas and trying to keep people away from the left. It's a new kind of idea for me, but it doesn't appeal to me. It certainly doesn't attract me. I've heard about it from Wolf Wall Street. I've heard about it from Tom Metzger. It just doesn't attract me at all. Daniel from Majority Rights is a part of that. He's pushing that too. And he says here, rather, this sounds stupid to me, but rather, as a white left, a white class, he combines the two, a white left and a white class, they're the same. We may keep a bead on those who can do us most harm, the elitists who mislead and betray us, the masses who follow them and scab us. So here he sees as the enemy the elitists and the masses too, because the masses follow the elitists and scab or, you know, do turn against the white left. The true white nationalists, as he would want them to be. The only other thing I have to say about this article, that's about all that's in this article. But the comments are interesting. And he says that he uses this word, this is typical of Daniel. He uses this word T-O-P-O-I, topoi, which is the plural of topol, T-O-P-O-L. Now, what is this? Why does he use this word? He says that in these past 45 years may have to do with rational criteria, topoi of classifications, postulating extended patterns of peoplehood, being prohibited by the right as leftist, exogenous, chimera, as much as with Jewish liberal leftism prohibiting these taxonomies of protracted human biological systems as racist. Well, I didn't start that at the beginning, but that's his last paragraph here. Another one of those tortured wordings, and he uses that word topoi, which is a Greek word for convention or motif. Now, why not? And I've seen him use this before. I've seen this word in his writings before, in other places. Now, why? See, he picks out, finds something like that, and then he uses it because nobody knows what it means. And they have to look it up or they don't know, and then he's real, he thinks he's real smart, you know, real highly educated. He could say motif, you know, but no, he uses this Greek word instead. This is just the typical, this is this guy's personality, which I find most unpleasant, most unpleasant. Now, I've got a bunch of stuff here, but it's probably kind of repetitive. But I'll read this after this article here by him. There's a comment by Goybel, somebody who spells his name G-O-Y-B-B-E-L-S, Goy and Goebbels combined, kind of. And he says the things that he's saying, Daniel are saying, and something about Hitler, before the invasion of Poland, Hitler gave permission to his commanders to kill without pity or mercy all men, women, and children of Polish descent and language, which is said by the Poles, but it's refuted by others that he never said that. But this person says, that gave me a good laughter. But to be serious for a moment, who believes in this crap, Mr. Sienkiewicz? Polish patriotard stooges of the late British Empire back then and U.S. lackeys nowadays like you? How is it anti-white if the Polish government has been and still is in a puppet under Jewish hegemony by U.S. as a proxy? Since Poland got her Lebensraum in the West, sadly not enough, like Berlin, for example, you won't skvetch about the Nazi Germanics that settled there long before the first Slavic tribes arrived, or the anti-white Prussians, right? It fascinates me that someone like you can get space to write something like this on a supposedly white, pro-white platform. I'm waiting for more anti-German drivel. I'm really enjoying your whining. Huh. Daniel S. writes back, he quotes something from someone. He says, I've looked into the pros and cons of NS Germany. They did some things right and some things very wrong. I know something of the nations adjacent to Germany, and they are nothing like they have been characterized by the Nazis or even by American media over the years. Now here, on May 30th, this is just the day after the podcast with Tan was posted here. A guest worker wrote on this thread to, he says, first thanks to Daniel for setting up the conversation with Tan and for the McLaughlin. It didn't go unnoticed. So Daniel was responsible for that. Then he says in answer to someone named Thorne, yes, there is a change from September at MR. That's 9 years and 11 months since we hit the tracks. The blog needs to be brought up to the mark in various respects, particularly with regard to a more upbeat atmosphere and more creativity. Daniel is the right person to accomplish that. Yeah, I just find this shocking. I think to have a bad enough opinion of guest worker, I should have a worse opinion of him, because for him to pick this Daniel to take over what he has put 9 years into, and it will be 10 years, and turn it over to this Daniel is just amazing to me. So he likes what he's doing, you know. And he says that Daniel has ideas, and he doesn't have any new ideas anymore. A guest worker doesn't. So he needs somebody younger with new ideas. Now, I just would be interesting to watch and see what happens there. Just a personal note on the conversation with Tan. I would like, in retrospect, to have done more to probe the boundaries of his focus on the Jewish question. My efforts in that direction were perhaps not very well considered. That aside, I was pleased with the show, and I won't. You know, the rest doesn't really amount to very much. But he did say at the end of that show, which I didn't copy down, but I do remember it very well, he did say it, yeah, even though Tan was there, that he was sorry he had hoped that Tan had was going on in some new directions, and he was a little disappointed that Tan seemed to be just going back to what he had done before, rather than, because he was still young enough, and rather than going and expanding himself in some way. So he did say that. So he can be critical or honest. Well, here's another thing that applies to me. Daniel S. then wrote, in a comment, Tan Stafford's maternal grandmother being German could explain his initial affinity for Carolyn Jaeger's perspective from a genetic standpoint. Male grandchildren and maternal grandmothers have more genetic attachment and more affinity as paternal grandmothers have to female grandchildren. Well, I just thought what bull that is. You know, I don't think that's true, but he feels he must explain how his Tan Staffel, who he is promoting, could have liked Carolyn Jaeger's perspective at all. But it's because he had this German grandmother that gave him some genetic affinity for what I was doing. Now here's guest worker again, and his attitude about the National Socialists is pretty bad. And he wrote this on May 31st in a comment. Obviously, I think somebody asked him about it, about what he said about this, and so he's answering. Obviously, there was an attempted genocide between 1941-45. When you imprison a people and separate man from woman, that is already a genocidal action. It is also very corrosive to the prison guard, which I thought was kind of funny. Like, he's worrying about the influence this is going to have on the guards. He says, which I spoke about, and which is a primary concern for someone like me interested in a European authenticity. So this was destroying the European feeling of connection in the prison guards by having to guard over these kinds of treatment of these people, even though so many of them were Jewish. He doesn't distinguish. Guest worker said, I don't mind Jews coming into our countries or coming into our lands. He said that. Amazing thing to say. I'm just going to go through here and see if I can find things that I thought were really more important. Now, here's something about Daniel S. tells you something. He said, he writes a comment on April 30th to Jimmy. Where is this from? This is from a different comment blog. We're back in April, under something else. And he said, under that one with, I know what it was, with Tom Metzger radio show. And he said, Jimmy, I invited the cowards from Renegade to debate me, and they did not take me up. I would guess they picked an easy mark instead. That is just one of the problems with that network. Reverence for Hitler is more important there than for European people. That's his thing he keeps griping about. The place is crawling with slimeball, heavy metal Hitler heads. There's no talking to them. Oh, and then Jimmy Mark answers back and says, John and Paul, he must mean Paul Hickman. Now, I don't know who John is, but this is April 30th. He says, John and Paul seem to have gotten along quite nicely. Oh, maybe that was the John, I think that was the John Beatty show. When Paul had John Beatty on as a guest. That's who he's talking about. They got along quite nicely. I don't have these in exact order. I mean, I just picked out a few that I thought were interesting. And he says, you know who would have been a great host for you, Daniel? Carolyn Jaeger. As you probably know, the White Network is defunct. But if Carolyn is still broadcasting at carolynjaeger.com, I bet she'd like to have you on. I think the two of you would hold similar views of National Socialism and opposing views of white nationalism. It'd make a great show. Now, I don't think he's being sarcastic. Of course, I can't say, is he sarcastic like that? But he's so often serious. He seems quite a sort of a, I don't know what to call it, like he's just not all there, or he doesn't understand everything. he's maybe in his own world a lot of the time and he doesn't really understand a lot. How Daniel and I would have similar views of National Socialism, I just don't know. We wouldn't. And opposing views of white nationalism, that would be right, probably. But I would never ask Daniel to be on. He thinks that people can just go and get on somebody's show. Well, again, I read this earlier where Daniel said that I'm not a white nationalist, I'm a German chauvinist. Okay, and his talk, his comments about Hitler's table talk and how awful it was, how awful it is, what Hitler says in there. And then he goes on to say, I didn't read this part before, she, meaning me, can be entertaining, her criticisms of white nationalist figures titillating and occasionally informative, perhaps as often disinformative, but she has provided a platform lending itself to a cultivation of her views of whites with horrifically mean-spirited Marcus. Well, Marcus is just an example of the mean-spirited people who come to my site and give their views, and inaccurate attitudes toward other whites, white nations, which they treat disingenuously, as a matter of fact. He said, oh, this is good. He says, she is a cute lady with strong logical rhetorical capacity for unanimity. It is too bad that she did not learn to speak German when she was young enough. Women speaking German is very sexy. Something fascinating about the tension between diminutive women speaking the mechanical, rigid, clumsy sounds of German and find a German knight to take her back to her homeland and have children. He said, sincerely, that seems to be too bad that that didn't happen. Now he's putting down the German language and calling it mechanical, rigid, clumsy. In obviously, you're supposed to compare it to the soft sounds of Polish. All over the world, people admire the German language. I love the German language. And he thinks that a woman speaking German being such a masculine language or something, it's just kind of strange and sexy. But here he's just showing his intense envy and critical attitude toward Germans in every aspect that you can come up with. So I'm looking here for any things that are, and I had, oh, here we have Marge O'Brien, who a lot of people know who she is. She hates me. It's a funny story. I could tell a story about her sometime. But she's over there at this website, and she writes a comment to the Terrible Tommy thread, and she says, hi, GW, guest worker. I'm glad I listened to this podcast. I'm favorably impressed by your comments. She says, I'm in sync with Terrible Tommy on strategy, not so much on joining hands, if I read him right, crossing fundamental boundaries. Good to hear Jimmy Marr's description and strategy of his own on-the-ground work. But then she says of Daniel S., I've always considered Daniel S. to be more enemy than ally. This is confirmed by his contributions to the broadcast and his comments above in this thread. Feel free, guest worker, GW, to toss Daniel S. out along with Albatross Leon Haller when you finally get around to doing that. You're right, making real change can take years to evolve. She doesn't like Daniel at all, and I know other people have spoken ill of him there, so I think it's kind of amazing. It's going to be interesting what's going to happen. Okay, here's another thing from this Daniel. In the same thread, he's talking about National Socialist standards of art, and he's putting forward Pierre Bonnard, the French impressionist, something of an impressionist, as for some reason, I guess he likes as he likes, and he's talking about National Socialist art. And then he says, the VOR, the Voice of Reason, is currently running a picture of the Honor Court entrance to Reich's Chancellery designed by Albert Speer. I guess it would be classic. Is that building supposed to be beautiful? I think not. It is a sterile, alienating, monotonous, hideous. But you know what's funny is that it wasn't the VOR that's running that ran that picture. It was my program, my Heretics Hour program post with that picture on it of the Honor Court entrance to the Reichs Chancellery. The Reichs Chancellery was a beautiful building. And this guy can't appreciate it because I don't know what he likes, but he just wants to insult it because it was put up by the National Socialists. Well, I've got some comments here from Hanning Scott and between he and Daniel, but I'm not going to get going in those because it's all about the same. So let's see what I can sum up here. I'm just going to have to come up with this. Why I did that, why I've done this show. Now, Daniel is in my idea of a misfit. He thinks that the rest of us are misfits. Daniel S. thinks that those who like National Socialism, and there's a lot that do and are not about to give it up, and those who thought the Third Reich was a fine example of white people gaining power and doing the right thing. But for Daniel, it can never be, and it's really because he's Polish. And Hanning Scott got it right by calling him a Polish chauvinist. And I believe that, well, I don't know what I call him, but he is that. That's exactly what he is. And chauvinism among Poles is the commonest thing in the world. Poles are known to be very, especially the leaders, but all of them. I'm sure there's some that aren't, but of course there are, but Poles learn. It's like that thing that people learn from in their culture. I was talking about what the English learn. Well, the Poles learn that they have been held back by both the Russians and the Germans, and sometimes some other peoples, but that they are a great people. They have a great and glorious past, and they do a lot of lying about their history in order to present it very, very special, you know, as brave and courageous. And so in this sense, then there's a lot of chauvinists among the Poles. So he fits right in. And this is an argument that can't stop. And there's no way that you can plaster over it that people say that let's do that. Let's quit this arguing among European peoples. But there's too many problems between the Poles and the Germans, if you're a real German, to do that. Some things have to be worked out, and truths have to be admitted. And I feel the same way about this business with Tan Staffel, I know what I did fail to. I'll just have to go on and say this. I need to explain why I consider him a traitor. So I do need to explain this. I could have done it sooner if I'd thought about it. But I need to explain that, say why I think that Tan Staffel was a traitor to me, because we had an understanding. I kind of explained it, but I didn't tie it in with being a traitor, because I always carried on my part better than I would even be expected to. And then he never said to me, he never explained to me what he had in mind and just what drastic measures he was intending to take. And because we had this 2-year agreement and we were very good friends we always were on good terms, except for a few little things that would come up, but we got over them. But in the beginning, we were very, very friendly. There was all this trust and good feeling. So, you know, he wasn't honest. What do traitors do? Traitors secretly conspire to work against their comrades or their countrymen. And in this case, he conspired to work against me without letting me know and not being on the up and up with me, destroying the network. A traitor is out to destroy his own country. So Tan destroyed this network that was the work of both of us, and plenty of my work into it, that's for sure, and never considered doing anything to save it. Never did. Like I said, if he would have been on the up and up with me and said, we have to make some decisions here, I could have handled that. I don't know what the decisions would have been. I don't know how it would have ended up, but I could have handled that, and we could have had a more congenial parting. It didn't have to be the way it was. The reason that it keeps going on now is because he keeps bringing it up. He has gone over to Metapedia. I talked about this, not on a program, but yes, I did on a program. He's gone over to Metapedia and written a bunch of stuff, and I've had to work real hard to try to get it evened out. So I think that he fits that that description in that word. Okay, well, I'm going to bring this show to a close now, ladies and gentlemen. The following Trainers and Misfits programs I'm going to have, I have one coming up with about Richard Sorge and a bunch of British traders during World War II who were working for the Russians. They all were, and a lot of interesting information about them, including about Victor Rothschild, who was one of them. That will be coming up at a future time. And I thank you for listening tonight. This is Carolyn Yeager saying goodnight for the Heretics Hour. Have a good week.